You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Nā koutou katoa, ko kēs te tōku ingoa, no mā haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Jude. If I can name coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to ACT MP Simon Court about proposals to reduce the number of government ministries and about what the ACT Party has for Auckland. I also spoke to Associate Professor of Law, Vernon Rive, about iwi leader and climate activist Mike Smith's new case against the New Zealand government. Jude, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to distinguished scholar and scientist Dr. Kevin Trenberth about the heatwave in Europe and the eastern half of the United States.
He aha or whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e wareware e ahena koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95bfm.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, the ACT Party announced a policy for the upcoming election that would involve reducing the number of government ministries. Currently, 78 portfolios are shared across 28 ministers, a number which ACT Party leader David Seymour says can be cut down to 18. While the ACT Party says this policy would streamline government, making things more efficient and generating savings, it's unclear what these savings would deliver for the public. Also last week, Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown released a series of interviews with MPs from various political parties. In each of these interviews, the Mayor discussed the state of the City of Auckland and what each political party can offer Aucklanders. Out of each party in Parliament, ACT and Te Pāti Māori were the only two to refuse an interview. For this week's catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I asked about each of these issues, beginning with the proposal to cut government departments. I want to start off today with the proposal from the ACT Party to reduce the number of ministries. ACT has been arguing for a smaller government for some time. What exactly would this smaller government look like, and would it be able to deliver the same things, in ACT's view, that the government currently delivers?
Indeed, it would. ACT's view is that a government should do fewer things, but do them properly. At the moment, big problems get split across too many agencies, whether that's housing, infrastructure, crime, welfare dependency. Everyone has a piece of work on them. There's so many ministries and ministers, but no one clearly owns the problem or the result. And so what that means from an agency point of view is expensive, slow, and frustrating, if you're a voter or a member of the public, really frustrating how long it takes for governments to get things done, or maybe just fail to get things done. ACT wants to bring our current 43 departments, 78 portfolios and 28 ministers into 19 departments instead of 43, 18 ministers instead of 28. And that's going to cut out a lot of duplication across head offices and comms and HR and finance teams, all these extra chief executives getting paid, some cases twice as much as a cabinet minister or the prime minister, and actually make it much clearer which ministry, which chief executive and which minister is responsible for getting things done.
Yeah, it's a big thing here, a big change that would be proposed, and there's a lot of jobs that would be cut if these changes were to go through. One thing that some people have raised concern over is, especially in health these last couple of years, we've seen some underinvestment leading into outages across the digital communication system, and we've seen that cybersecurity issues. So we've seen that potentially back office cuts can create problems for frontline services. Is this a worry? Is ACT confident that changes like this wouldn't affect the frontline at all?
Look, we're absolutely clear that we want the government to perform better and we wanted to deliver better for New Zealanders. So, of course, you know, when you are looking at functions of an organisation and working out where those functions should be placed and how they should be funded and prioritised, it's important not to let things slip. But let's be clear, under the previous government, they ran essentially a restructuring of the health system during a global pandemic. They spent $1 billion on the restructure, and at the end of it, they had a spreadsheet to run a $28 billion organisation. So, of course, yeah, if you don't do it properly, things will slip through the cracks. But we're a totally different government. You know, my background is in civil engineering, project management. I've been through a number of organisational restructures myself. You know, as different project teams work out of a project and we need to then reallocate people's resources and time into new projects. Now, that's what businesses do every day. And yet government doesn't do it. All that happens is a new problem gets discovered, a new agency, department, minister, chief executive get created for it, and the problem still doesn't get solved. ACT has a different approach, and we're confident we can retain frontline services. And there's no proposal to cut teachers, police, nurses, for example. This is about making sure we've identified the right functions, allocated them into the right business unit or department, and a minister responsible for delivering that.
Is there a worry around concentration of power? As ministries get smaller, obviously, there's more responsibilities on the minister responsible. Is there a worry of, you know, maybe concentrating power in the hands of a smaller and smaller group of people?
Well, remember that power derives from the voters and from the legislation that Parliament passes. Power does not derive from a minister, except in very limited circumstances where ministers have the power to override or direct. So not concerned at all. In fact, what we're aiming for is greater accountability and delivering on what governments get elected to deliver. Because at the moment, if you're, say, appointed, I don't know, the Minister for Building and Construction, like my colleague Chris Pink is, when it comes to setting building standards or consumer safety standards for building products, his part of MBIE, which has about 20 ministers, I understand, responsible for different bits of it, his part of it only deals with a few building products, and yet consumer safety and some of the other standards are under the Minister of Consumer Affairs and over in the Commerce Commission. Unless we can actually consolidate government's effort to respond to New Zealanders' needs, all we're going to do is grow government, make it more expensive, and solve fewer problems. And that's not going to help New Zealand in the long run.
And one of the big things on the other side is, I guess, where the money is going. We've seen this government as well make a lot of cuts, and a lot of these cuts were advertised as ways to save the government money, but also to pass on some of those benefits to members of the public. However, the cost of living hasn't really gone down that much. Inflation has dropped, but that's not been a material impact on people's wallets. Where would this money go from any of the savings ACT is looking to make here?
Well, let me just address your comments straight up. This government has reduced spending, and as a result of government spending less and higher quality spending actually delivering stuff like infrastructure, frontline services, and allowing people to keep more of what they earn, what that means is the government's share of spending in the economy has been less than it would have been under the previous government. And so you're right, interest rates have come down, because that is the Reserve Bank responding to, essentially, the heat being taken out of the economy. Now, when interest rates come down, that means that mortgage payers pay less, and it means that renters who would otherwise have been subject to higher rents because their landlord's mortgage interest rates have gone up are paying the same, or in some cases, less than they would otherwise. So there has been a material impact, positive impact on the cost of living from the government's actions. Now, we are not in control of other things, like, you know, the cost of imported fuel, for example, which has had a major impact on household budgets. But there are other things that we've done, you know, such as, you know, providing $50 a week for households that qualify for the fuel compensation payment. So, look, we're in a long game here, turning this economy around. It's taken decades to, from our previous peak productivity back in the early 2000s, when New Zealand was, you know, working really hard but producing a lot of good results and earning good money for it, to now where we're actually working harder and producing less per person than we were 20 years ago. We're in a turnaround situation. This is hard work.
I want to address one of those examples you raised. You said that rents haven't gone up as a result of this government doing something. I understand that is obviously a positive benefit for many people, anyone paying rent, myself included, but that's not a benefit. That's just a negative thing not happening. We still see unemployment rates extremely high. Youth unemployment has hit its all-time peak multiple times during this government's term. We're still seeing the cost of groceries really high. We're still seeing wages remain relatively similar. Is this money and is this proposal from ACT going to change any of those things?
Look, what ACT wants to do by shrinking the size of government, reducing the cost of government, is mean that people like you, students who are studying for a degree or qualification going into the workforce, actually are facing less cost. Because, you know, while you said your rent not going up is not a benefit, I tell you what, if the previous government was still in, and remember, house prices increased 40% under the previous Labor government, 40%. There are people who were priced out of the market and some who feel they can never get back on the property ladder. Look, by reducing government spending, getting interest costs down, you know, reducing costs on landlords, that is having a positive impact. Those are costs that people like yourself and other renters are avoiding. And what that means is you can think about saving money for the next thing that you need, whether it's a car, whether it's to get into a better flat, or, you know, really important things like a home or having kids. So these things take time, but the structural settings in the economy and for government, if we get them right, it means we're setting New Zealanders up for a much wealthier and healthier future.
But the things you're saying here, again, Simon, are costs not going up. People in the public, members of the public, who are facing extremely high grocery prices right now, extremely high cost of living right now, and do not have wages that are proportional to that, want either prices to go down or wages to go up. And you haven't said anything here that is indicating that either of those things would happen. Can you promise that prices of anything would go down instead of just not going up, or that wages would go up relative to any price increases?
Look, the government is not in the business of controlling prices. That is not possible. But what we can do is set the economic conditions so that your wages do increase faster than the cost of living. And the only way to do that is to increase productivity. That is the amount of output that you produce per hour of work. Like I said, around 20 years ago, New Zealanders were producing more per hour worked than we are now. There's a reason for that. It's because government has increased the size of the economy. Remember, government is a cost on the economy. Government is not a benefit to the economy. Red tape, regulation, the Resource Management Act, the fact that we now need 40,000 consents a year instead of the 5 to 10,000 we needed in the 1990s, none of that adds to our welfare as a nation. So there's a lot of work we're doing to cut red tape, improve productivity, and make sure that when you do go into the workforce and you're embarking on a career, that your employer can afford to give you decent pay rises because they're making more profit. That only comes when a government sets the structural settings that allow businesses to grow, invest in land and buildings, hire people, train them, and you know, invest in that human capital, which is what New Zealand needs right now.
Recently, the Mayor, Wayne Brown, posted a series of interviews with multiple political parties or MPs from political parties. ACT was one of the political parties that refused to do one of these interviews. Is there any reason for that?
Well, Aucklanders don't need Wayne Brown spending council money on flash TikToks while hiking rates by almost 8%. So, you know, we're not wasting time on any TikToks with Wayne Brown. You know, I've been very clear in my communication with Wayne Brown that he should be taking this opportunity while faced with additional costs from things like the City Rail Link to actually look at some of the wasteful spending, like these ridiculous compost bins that they have a fleet of trucks driving around the city to collect. You know, barely 30% of households would put these things out on a regular basis. Total waste of money. And then you think about, you know, what else could we do for Auckland? Well, ACT would abolish the Minister for Auckland. It's like a mascot portfolio that takes resources away from the important functions of government. Aucklanders complain about housing, transport, infrastructure, their council performance. And so the government having a standalone Auckland portfolio gives the appearance of doing something without fixing anything. So the real work, and that's work I'm involved in and leading some aspects of, is resource management reform, getting rid of this red tape so we need to apply for fewer consents, and infrastructure funding so that we can actually get the infrastructure built that delivers services where people need it, and so we can build more houses. And you know, if Wayne Brown focused on that instead of TikToks, you know, Aucklanders might be more satisfied with his performance.
Bed levies, another big thing. The ACT Party has been opposed to the bed levy, and as far as I can tell, is the only party that is actively opposed to the bed levy in Auckland. Wayne Brown says, and many other councillors say, that it'll improve funding for arts and culture in the city. Hotel operators say that they're also keen to have it. It seems that everyone is supportive of this policy, except for the ACT Party. Why is that?
Well, you'll notice that the coalition government hasn't introduced a bed levy, so you could probably expand, you know, which parties in government are not keen on a bed levy to the government. But ACT is very clear, and you know, I'm proud that we've managed to stop that so far. We do not need new taxes. You know, councils like Auckland collects over $3.5 billion a year in revenue. If they can't find cuts of say a couple of tens of millions or hundreds of millions to fund infrastructure, investment in arts and culture and events, you know, what on earth is the central government supposed to do? These people have a responsibility to their city. You know, we have countless cruise ships arrive, discharging thousands of people at a time. We do have major events here. We've got Eden Park. You know, these guys couldn't even get out of bed to find some money to support the America's Cup style, you know, AC42 event, and they expected the government to pick up the tab for it. They're not serious people, so there will be no bed tax if ACT's in government. But what we have done is we've actually taken $400 million of GST revenue in this budget, and we've put it aside for infrastructure. So the councils like Auckland who complain they don't have enough money to spend for infrastructure, if they consent more houses, they can then apply for a proportion of that $400 million fund based on the number of houses they consent. That is what ACT is focused on. But these councils need to get real. Instead of demanding more taxes, what they should be doing is looking to transfer money from wasteful things like a stupid compost bin collection at the side of the road, which costs tens of millions of dollars a year, into something that Aucklanders actually need, you know, like infrastructure, events funding, you know, whatever it is, it's actually going to make the city a better place to live.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about a policy to reduce the number of government ministries and interviews the ACT Party declined with Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Glitters by No Romance.
We could be sweet, I want to try. Netherlands, from all the young coats, race horses laugh so hopeful, stiff bricks in the general direction. I'm anywhere but home. Nothing's gonna happen. Maybe all the children in small rooms will fall silent at a wall, a window, and forget to breathe for just 1 minute because of some beauty that has not been altered. Damn, or pointed out by the clumsy dark oafs who train them. Nothing's gonna happen. 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 Then again, all the time, every minute, never ending, unrelenting, all around us, without pausing, endless, endless, all pervading, moving motion, this way, that way, that way, our way, tick tock, free fall, love, love, kiss, kiss, make, do, be, is, was, I, me, be, see, be, e, f, g, h, I think nothing's gonna happen. Silent in a wall or window, and forget to breathe for just 1 minute because of some beauty that has not been altered and pointed out by the clumsy dog who trained them. Nothing's gonna happen. Nothing's gonna happen. Nothing's gonna happen.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Nothing's Gonna Happen by The Tall Dwarfs.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Iwi leader and climate activist Mike Smith had put forward a landmark climate litigation case against major polluters in New Zealand, set to be heard in April next year. The government, however, changed the law this year to prevent this case from going forward, claiming that it reduced business confidence in the legal system. Smith, in response, has launched a new case against the government directly, claiming that in putting forward this change, the government only consulted with the defendants and did not talk to him. To discuss the full situation, the likelihood of success for Smith, and the ramifications of this case going forward, I spoke to Associate Professor of Law, Vernon Rive.
So I think we are going to start with something about the legal background to the Smith and Fonterra case itself.
Yeah, I think that's a good spot to start because it feels like, I mean, maybe a lot of people haven't heard about it, but in law circles it was discussed as sort of being a fairly groundbreaking case.
Yeah.
Could you go into why that was and why this case was seen as so important?
Yeah, so Mike Smith, he's an iwi leader from Northland. He's got customary interests in land up there, and he sued six of the largest emitters in New Zealand. These are companies such as Fonterra, Genesis, New Zealand Steel. And what he was arguing was that their activities were contributing to climate change effects, which were damaging his land and the land of his whānau and iwi, and that the contributions towards greenhouse gas emissions that those big companies made were what's called civil wrongs to him. So this is torts in legal terms, and that the courts should do something about it. So it was a big deal because most of the litigation on climate change issues so far has been in the public area, not really involving these private law claims such as torts. So he was met with an application to stop that proceeding happening at all by the corporate defendants. This is called a strikeout claim. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, which ruled after some major hearings in early 2024 that Mike Smith's claim should go to trial. And this was groundbreaking both in New Zealand and also internationally, because it provided an opportunity for the courts to really have a hard look at whether these ancient legal mechanisms of torts could be used in the 21st century in the climate change context. And that that hearing was set down to be heard in the High Court over 15 weeks. It would be New Zealand's longest climate change trial. That was due to start in April of 2027. But then in May of this year, after lobbying by corporate interests, including some of the defendants in this case, the Minister of Justice, Paul Goldsmith, announced that the government was going to introduce legislation that would stop the case from going ahead and would prohibit any other cases like it from being launched.
What are the grounds behind the government making this change, and why have they, what's the argument for why they've brought it about, I guess?
So the minister says that the case is, in his words, creating uncertainty in business confidence and investment that the government must address. So the government's taken the view that the challenge of reducing climate change emissions in New Zealand should be one that is not addressed through the courts, but instead is addressed through this national statutory framework, the Climate Change Response Act, and primarily through the Emissions Trading Scheme, and not the courts. And the government thinks that if people are allowed to bring claims in the courts, which might result in rulings from judges that companies should do things or should not do things, that this would create regulatory incoherence that this uncertainty for businesses is not helpful. So instead, as I said, the government has announced that it's going to introduce legislation, and in fact it has now introduced legislation that, if Parliament passes it, would stop that Smith and Fonterra case from going ahead even before it had gone to trial.
And so now Smith has gone ahead and said he's going to take the government to court over this change. Now, I'm guessing the legal situation here is slightly different because it's concerning a different decision that's been made. But what's his, I guess, legal basis for making this new claim now?
Yeah, so as you said, he's filed this new claim in the High Court, which is challenging the government's decision-making process, which led up to that announcement by Paul Goldsmith to legislate over the case. And Mike Smith's new claim, it involves a number of points, but broadly he's arguing that the minister and cabinet have acted in ways which were unfair and illegal towards him, and that they've breached the government's legal obligations, and therefore the courts should declare that the decision-making process leading to the announcement of the prohibition of the claim was flawed and unlawful. So one of the parts of the claim relates to who the government spoke to when making up its mind on how to respond to this case. And Smith is arguing that the government had engaged with representatives of the corporate defendants, but hadn't talked to him when they were coming up with their decision to introduce this legislation. And so he says the government acted in a procedurally unfair way. So that's one arm to the argument. One of the other arms to the argument is that the government has acted in a way which is contrary to its obligations under this new piece of legislation called the Regulatory Standards Act. And that Regulatory Standards Act sets out principles for making legislation. And one of the things it does, or one of the principles, is that legislation shouldn't take away people's rights and their property rights without their consent, without good justification, and without fair compensation, and without consulting the people who are directly impacted. And so he's saying, I was never spoken to about this. I was never consulted for the cabinet decision to ban my court case. Not only kind of breaches long-standing constitutional principles, but it goes against the principles in this Regulatory Standards Act. So he's asked the court, as I said, for a declaration that that decision-making process was unlawful. And he's asking for the court, in effect, to send the government back to the drawing board to come up with a, with something different. Now, so I've got to say, the claim is a hugely ambitious one. And it's ambitious in part because it seeks to get a court ruling that would prevent the government from introducing legislation to do something that it wants to do. And this comes close to cutting across these long-standing principles of separation of powers, where we have these different branches of government. We've got the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. And under New Zealand's constitutional framework, each of these branches of government should be letting the other branch do their thing without interference. And this type of claim would come close to the judicial branch interfering with the role of both the executive branch and the legislative branch in doing what they do. It would potentially stop Parliament from being able to pass laws, which Parliament might want to pass, and it would stop the executive from implementing its legislative agenda. You know, the electorally developed executive, we voted for him, and he's asking for the court to stop the executive branch from doing what it wants to do. And this type of claim, Not the very first time that it's been brought before the courts, but almost always these claims don't succeed because the courts are very reluctant to be interfering with the legitimate activities of another branch. You know, the judges might have their own view on the best policy here, but they also recognise that the courts have their role, the executive has its role, and Parliament has its role, and it would be generally regarded as inappropriate for the courts to interfere with this process. Many commentators, and me included, think that there are pretty low prospects of success for this claim. I think it's highly unlikely that there would be a declaration that the government has acted unlawfully here. I never say never, because litigation is always uncertain, and Mike Smith has got some brilliant lawyers acting for him, but I think the chances of success are low.
Yeah, that being said, I mean, we've seen on the government side as well, this change and a variety of other changes that they've introduced during this term have been directly in this vein of following up on a High Court ruling and changing the law so that it's no longer valid. Is that also some kind of interference between the branches, as you described earlier?
Yeah, absolutely, it is. And the government interference with a court proceeding, especially a court proceeding that had already started, that had been right the way through the High Court, Court of Appeal, and Supreme Court. Supreme Court said this should go to trial, and then the government has introduced legislation which, if passed, would stop that hearing kind of going ahead. And that itself, as you said, it cuts across another longstanding constitutional principle, and it itself is a breach of the separation of powers principle. But we have this constitutional framework in New Zealand, for better or worse, where Parliament reigns supreme. We have parliamentary supremacy, and if Parliament has the numbers, if the political parties or the coalition have the numbers, and they do, then they are able to pass laws, even if constitutionally dubious. They still have the legal powers to be passing laws to do these sorts of things. You know, I said that I didn't think that this claim would succeed. That doesn't mean that it's completely futile. There are ways in which litigation can be brought, and even if a case is unsuccessful, it might still serve some objectives for the litigants. So it's possible that even if the High Court dismisses this claim, possibly in doing so, the judge might make some comments about the way that the government and the minister and cabinet have acted, which would be helpful for Mike Smith for his kind of broader campaign, which is looking to encourage both corporate entities and the government to do more on climate change. One of the other ways in which the case might be helpful strategically for Mike Smith is that when claims are lodged in court, there's an opportunity to do what's called discovery. This is where you can require the other party to provide documents or copies of documents which are relevant to the matters in the claim. And it may be that this is part of an attempt by Mike Smith to get more documentary evidence about exactly what was going on in the government decision-making process. The government has made public some documents, but probably not all, and there might be further information which would be relevant to this kind of broader campaign for Mike Smith as a result of this. Maybe one other thing to mention is that Mike Smith has another case which is currently before the courts. This is another ambitious claim against the Attorney General as the representative of the New Zealand government, arguing that the government and the Climate Change Response Act under which the government operates is inherently incapable of satisfying the government's treaty obligations to Māori relating to climate change. And that case is set down for hearing in the Supreme Court on the 17th of August, a little over a month away. And so it's possible that this latest claim by Mike Smith, the existence of that claim might in some way be helpful to his other claim, which is before the Supreme Court, which is coming up for argument in about 6 weeks' time.
We talked about earlier how this case, the initial case, Smith versus Fonterra, was celebrated as sort of a way to open up this realm of climate law or climate litigation in New Zealand. Is that still something that's on the table, or has this been cut off? And if it's been cut off, are there any other pathways that people are looking into right now?
Yeah, so if the legislation stopping the case is passed, as it seems it will, then that opportunity for development of tort law in New Zealand relating to climate change will effectively be stopped. It doesn't mean that that Mike Smith's campaign will stop, because he's got other irons in the fire. There is that Supreme Court hearing against the Attorney General that I mentioned. There are also some international processes which are occurring. There is a request to have the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Climate Change to investigate the way that the New Zealand government is acting, in particular towards Māori here. There is a Waitangi Tribunal claim on climate change, which is also working its way through the process. These sorts of issues and this campaign by Mike Smith and others is part of a really long game, I think. And the fact that perhaps the Smith and Fonterra proceeding might be stopped might close that door, but there are other irons in the fire, as I mentioned. And Mike Smith and other Māori and other litigants are taking a really long approach, a long game approach to this. These issues are not going to go away, and they will continue to be argued both before the courts, before the Waitangi Tribunal internationally, and also before the Court of Public Opinion in New Zealand. So the issues are not going away.
That was Associate Professor of Law Vernon Rive speaking to me about Mike Smith versus the government in light of Mike Smith versus Fonterra being put on hold. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Quickly by Hoha.
We'll be right back. So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Europe and the eastern half of the United States are currently experiencing an intense heat wave. This heat wave is caused by a strong high-pressure weather pattern, or otherwise known as an anticyclone or a heat dome. This traps a large amount of hot air, which then sinks to the ground. It brings with it dry and sunny days. The current anticyclone has been stuck in place for roughly 2 weeks, with the trapped air absorbing more heat on the daily. Heat waves are considered the most dangerous type of weather event, with an approximated 20,000 heat-related deaths in Europe alone. The eastern half of the United States has also seen some extreme consequences from the heat, with at least 25 deaths confirmed over this weekend. The extreme heat has also coincided with Independence Day celebrations, prompting warnings that such hot and dry conditions could increase the risk of wildfires in some places. Heat waves to this extent aren't caused purely by weather, but are driven by global warming and climate change. To learn more about this heat wave, its causes, and what we can do about it, I spoke to distinguished scholar and scientist Dr. Kevin Trenberth. Europe is once again experiencing an extreme summer heat wave. This time, however, the United States is also coming through with some heat over the Independence Day weekend. What's the immediate cause of this? And are these isolated events, or are we seeing a broader pattern emerging?
Well, both. Broader pattern happening, which is a part of the global climate change, and that's certainly affecting New Zealand as well. And I can comment on that in just a minute. But the immediate cause, of course, is these things called heat domes, which is really a large slow-moving anticyclone, sometimes called a blocking anticyclone, where in the northern hemisphere, these can hang around for 10 days, maybe 2 weeks. In New Zealand, they tend to hang around for maybe up to about a week. The westerlies here are stronger. And so that sets very settled, sunny weather. The sun beams down, pollution increases, heat becomes excessive. They've had temperatures over 40 degrees Celsius, and there have been reported over, or estimated over 20,000 deaths throughout Europe, maybe 860 in the UK, largest number in France and Germany of order of 5,000, and Spain and Italy, Spain about 3,000, and Italy a little under 3,000. That's the estimate at the moment. And of course, over the 4th of July weekend, just the day before, there was a huge area in the eastern parts of the United States that was over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, about, let's see, 35, close to 40 degrees, slightly under 40 degrees over extensive areas. And even today, it's quite warm in Washington, D.C. And so this has led to cancellation or changes in the celebrations for the 4th of July. Cutting down on fireworks, for instance, the risk of fire. No doubt there were a lot of small fires around. But in addition to the heat, and a lot of these deaths have been because of people not having air conditioning and not being able to get to cooler conditions, so they overheated. But also some of them are from drowning. People are trying to get relief and going for a swim and not coping.
You mentioned these cyclones. Is this just weather? I mean, how much of it is being actually influenced by climate change?
Yeah, so the climate change aspect relates to overall global warming, and there's another factor under play at the moment, which is the developing El Nino in the tropical Pacific. And so that brings very high sea surface temperatures, and that pumps up the convection in the tropics, throughout the tropics. And at the moment, that's certainly in play. What it means is that all of that air is rising in the tropics over the oceans, but then it subsides somewhere, and that's in the subtropical anticyclones. And one way to think about the climate change aspect is that the subtropics are getting a bit wider, and so that affects New Zealand as well. And certainly we've seen this winter, most of the storms have been to the south of New Zealand, and we've had the odd storm like now that has camped out over New Zealand for a little bit. But we've also had a remarkable amount of sunny weather in June, for instance. And similar sorts of things are in play in Europe and in North America. The jet stream and the main storms have tended to shift a little bit further to the north, and this seems to be related to the global climate change, which is associated with human activities, the increases in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So global warming is the other way that's often referred to. And so changes are underway. There's always weather and, you know, variability on top of that. And these are not permanent states of affairs, but they tend to prevail overall.
You've slightly mentioned this already, but what do these heat waves mean for wildfire risk and for communities living in vulnerable areas?
So with the heat waves, with the anticyclonic fine weather conditions, that means there's a lot of extra heat available. And where does that heat go? Well, the first thing it does is it dries out the surface. It increases evaporation, it evaporates moisture, then the plants begin to wilt, and at some point when the soil moisture has dried up, the plants become very vulnerable for any wildfire around, any sparks, whether it's deliberate in some cases or whether it's accidental and maybe even from lightning or something like that. And so the risk of wildfire certainly goes up, varies a lot, and it depends on the available vegetation. And so whether it's indeed wild or whether it's managed on a farm, maybe there's some irrigation and watering that's available, for instance. This is true also in New Zealand, although in New Zealand the biggest risk is associated with the very heavy rains that we get from time to time. And just now we've had some very heavy rains in the Dunedin area, for instance. That goes along with the warming atmosphere being able to hold more moisture. Some of that moisture, when it comes down from the tropics, is what has caused our biggest floods and erosion.
You've said previously that with the way that we're going, this heat wave may seem moderate in the future. What do you mean by that, and how concerned should we be about this?
Well, climate change is underway. It's caused by human activities. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is at its highest level ever. It continues to increase. Maybe there's been a slight decrease in the rate of increase, but carbon dioxide continues to increase. We're still emitting, or we as a whole globally are still emitting far too much and burning fossil fuels and putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and methane also contributes. And so global warming is happening, and it's going to continue. It will continue at least for the next decade or two. And if we took very strong actions now, as recommended by the United Nations, for instance, then we may be able to slow the rate of increase down and possibly lower it to a point where it the changes in the climate become more manageable. That's certainly the goal. I mean, at the moment, there's been a 50% increase in carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide could well double for 2050. It will certainly double, you know, sooner or later, not too far from there. And then the question is, later in the century, what are the prospects then? And so the prospects for global warming continue, and there's been no sign that, as a whole, we are getting this under control.
Looking ahead, what should governments and individuals be doing to prepare for a future where extreme heat, like what we're seeing currently, is likely to become much more regular during summer?
Well, two things. Firstly, we should be taking more actions to cut down on the use of fossil fuels and cut down on the problem, slow down the rates of change of climate change, and that allows us to so-called adapt to climate change. And so that's the other aspect of it, is we should be building resilience in many ways. In Europe, that probably means adding more cooling centers, for instance, and making sure that there's adequate water available. In New Zealand, we have to worry quite a lot about really heavy rains and coastal erosion and rising sea levels. Already, there's a lot of places around the country that are under threat, and the question is, can you build a seawall that will help at least temporarily, but in the longer term, people should be building in better places, safer places. You know, maybe Christchurch is an example. Following the earthquake, a lot of the flooding that occurred in association with the River Avon, and a lot of the developments have been further away from the coast and in regions that are much less subject to flooding. And so there's been some really good changes that have occurred in the Christchurch area But other areas in Auckland and in Wellington are also vulnerable. And so assessing the risk, assessing the vulnerability, and then doing something about it, planning for it ahead of time, is the sort of things that individuals should do, but also it should be done by governments.
That was distinguished scholar and scientist Dr. Kevin Trenberth speaking to me about the climate change-driven heat wave in Europe and the eastern half of the United States.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, Associate Professor Vernon Rive, and Dr. Kevin Trenberth. Nei rā hoki, te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you also for all of your texts and calls, especially about the interview with Simon Court. Always the highlight of my week. So thank you all for letting us know your opinions. You're listening to 95 BFM. Stay tuned because next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.